Welcome to Variant Frequencies. Month to month, our podcast brings you fiction stories from a different channel. Sci-fi, fantasy, horror, and some odd bands in between. Visit us at www.variantfrequencies.com. Hello, I'm Rick Stringer. We have a wonderfully disturbing story for you this month. I do want to warn you, if you're easily offended, then this is not the story for you. Our story is Under the Bridge, Downtown, by Gary A. Brombeck and Matthew Warner. It will also be in the Anthology Horror Library, Volume 3, from Cutting Block Press. Now, I'm going to shut up, because we have a special introduction. Now on to our story.
Hi, I'm Gary Brombeck, and along with Matt Warner, I wrote the story Under the Bridge Downtown, which you are about to listen to. Now, when Rick Stringer first approached us with the idea of doing an audio recording of this story, his initial suggestion was that both Matt and I do a full recording of the story. That means each of us would read the story in its entirety, and Rick and his team of editors, which consists of Rick, and sometimes Rick, would then go through the audio files, take the best sections out of each, and combine them. Now, initially, I thought this was a pretty terrific idea, because it would give listeners a chance to hear both Matt's and my vocal interpretations of this story. Matt was the first person to get his recording done and into Rick, and I listened to it and was absolutely floored by his interpretation, and I'll tell you why. Matt has a tendency in his public readings to really perform. I'm talking throw himself into a role like Olivier threw himself into Richard III, and sometimes Matt can get a little overzealous, let's say. Ask him to tell you the story about the time hotel security was called into one of his readings because people passing by the room thought someone was being murdered. Anyway, Matt sent a copy of his recording to both Rick and myself, and when I listened to it, I was impressed not only by his interpretation of the story, but by the way he downplayed everything. This is by far, in my opinion, the single best reading Matt Warner has ever given, and I was damned if I was going to taint that in any way, or hurt it in any way, by having Rick go through and insert sections of my reading the story. So I wanted to offer my congratulations to Matt. Buddy, you are turning in to a first-rate reader. I wanted to thank Rick and everyone else associated with the podcast, and I also want to thank you. And even though this story has some extreme moments in it, I don't consider it extreme horror. What you're about to hear is a story that deals with what I think is an unflinching view of survivor's guilt. But regardless, you're going to love Matt's reading, because I know I did.
Under the Bridge Downtown by Gary A. Brombeck and Matthew Warner. The worst part about his daughter's death wasn't the terror of seeing half a ton of concrete separate from a bridge and smash through their windshield. It wasn't even the deafening crunch when the fragment pulped Jessie's head and sent her blood splattering over his cheek. It was his initial reaction once the shock wore off. Relief. Because shame followed that relief. How do you dare celebrate what happened to her? She's your daughter, you selfish prick. Then the worst realization. In a way, you wanted this to happen, didn't you? Maybe even secretly wished for it to happen. All your life, you've believed your darkest wishes made in the dead of night come true. That's why Aunt Claire got emphysema when you were 6, the spiteful bitch. Always blew her cigarette smoke into your face. You wish she'd die of it, and then she did. Jesse's death is your fault. David Brolin had drowned in these thoughts every day for the past year. Especially now, with the first anniversary approaching, he couldn't stand it. He looked up from stirring the slop in the elementary school cafeteria where he worked and saw fresh-faced little kids grinning at him over the serving line. They held out their cardboard trays for an ice cream scoop full of mashed potatoes. Each kid, each normal, healthy kid, reminded him of peering over the same line and wishing the child looking back was his own. But those wishes never came true. Instead, he'd been stuck with the spasm-racked pretzel of human flesh. He'd wanted, hoped that, prayed for Jessie's cerebral palsy to improve enough so she could attend this school and stand in line so she could smile at Daddy as he dished out the food. Before she died, David's life was measured not by morning, noon, and night, but by caring for Jessie, slinging slop in the cafeteria, and hating his ex-wife for leaving him with this burden. He'd been nothing but an overweight, angry, bearded little man who wore a shower cap half the day. Then the concrete fell down, manna from heaven, leaving him to quail at the echoes of his own thoughts. Wish she would just die. "You don't look so good, partner," said Ray, the school custodian, when the last lunch shift was over. He rested his chin on his mop handle and watched David's hands shake as he pulled off his shower cap. "Hitting the bottle again?" David gave the ponytail man a sharp look. "Just because I used to have a drinking problem doesn't mean I'm always falling off the wagon. You have no right to... Hey, take it easy. Just a little rib between friends, that's all." David wanted to ask when they became friends. He sighed as he stuffed the cap into his duffel bag and put on his coat to go home. "Hey, partner, come on. It's Friday. Why don't you come down to the docks with me? We'll, you know, get us some hookers and start the weekend off right." David looked to make sure they were alone. "Are we actually having this conversation?" He didn't wait for an answer, just left. As he settled in behind the wheel minutes later, he marveled that stupid Ray didn't somehow choke to death on his own ponytail while sleeping. Like someone with cerebral palsy. "Huh? You walking, talking, breathing pile of shit? Is that what you were going to think next? Better start writing that speech for the Humanitarian of the Year award that's no doubt coming your way." He was distracted enough by his anger and self-loathing that he drove right past the West 25 exit off the highway. Now he would have to drive until he reached the Whipple Road exit. Well, so much the better. Might as well get it all out of his system today. Because between here and Whipple Road was the bridge that killed Jessie. Nothing like a little drive down memory lane. Within 2 months of the accident, David sued the city and the successor to the construction company that built the bridge 30 years ago. It didn't cost him a dime since his attorney worked on contingency.
"This is one of the most clear-cut wrongful death claims I've seen in a long time," lawyer said in the beginning, knobby fingers stroking a stack of newspaper accounts of what happened. "It's negligence per se. A great race heaps a case. We don't have to prove nothing other than that the bridge fell down."
Even now, almost a year downstream, it wasn't over. The city blamed the builders blamed the engineers blamed the suppliers. The case was continued to give time to find objective evidence of negligence, but no one could explain how it happened. The engineers had designed the bridge flawlessly. The construction company used the best materials. All the codes of the time were observed. Then, 2 months ago, the construction company declared bankruptcy for unrelated reasons, and David's attorney needed time to ask a bankruptcy court for permission to proceed with the suit. This could drag on for years. But the part that hurt, really hurt, came during his deposition. A defense lawyer, trying to hide a smirk, looked him in the eyes and said,
"Mr. Brolin, the law says you're entitled to be compensated for the loss of your daughter's companionship, love, and affection. Can you cite any examples of how your daughter furnished these things to you?"
The best David could come up with was, "Well, she smiled sometimes."
"I see."
And he quit trying to hide his smirk. That fucking snake. He knew. He knew David's life wasn't worse for losing his daughter. The only thing that made it worse was guilt, but admitting that wouldn't help his case. And dear God, the man was right. He didn't deserve any compensation for his daughter's death. In the meantime, the world hadn't stopped as it should have. Bills still needed to be paid. Kids still came through the serving line for their slop. And the bridge was rebuilt. He never wanted to see it again. That's why he always exited at West 25 and not at Whipple Road like he used to. It added 10 minutes to his commute, but it was worth it. What was he in a hurry to get home to anyway? His water-stained ceiling? The books he never read because he was too tired? How about Jesse's wheelchair still folded against the back of the coat closet? It still puzzled him that he couldn't bring himself to throw the damn thing away. Christ, how many times had he gone to bed with sore shoulders from pushing her dead weight around all day long? How many times had he spent the few precious hours he had to himself with oiling the wheels or tightening the brakes or... Stop it. Stop it. Right the hell now. How about the meaningless crayon scribbles held to the refrigerator by a magnet? That's what he should have told the defense attorney about. Da, Jesse had said as she beat on the scribble with a contorted hand. Da, Daddy, look what I didn't do. Look what I didn't write your name. I didn't draw your picture. Da, look at your pretzel girl. Da, wipe me and feed me and marvel at me, your living monument to a failed and miserable existence. Look at me and your memory. Da, now that I'm dead. Look at me and remember how you wished me gone. I was handicapped, but I was still a little girl. I still loved you. That scribble was all I could give you. I didn't deserve to die. Why did you kill me? And why don't you cry still? Was that too much to ask, Doc? A few tears, some sign of it, anything to you. Anything at all. I tried to be good, I did. I never thought you weren't good enough. Duh. And now, at last, for the first time since her death, David choked back a sob as the bridge swung into sight. Please, fall on me. It looked different now. Not brownstone, but white. Beneath the bridge, smooth slopes angled away from either side of the road, covering supporting embankments of earth that hadn't been there before. The slopes slanted upward until they met the underside of the bridge at acute angles of darkness. He stared at the one on his left as he passed under. It was so black up there at the top of the slope. He couldn't see where it met the... He slammed on his brakes, tires squealing, heart pounding. He angled into the turnaround lane reserved for police vehicles. No! Couldn't be. He made a sloppy U-turn and drove back under the bridge, parked on the shoulder, ignoring the irritated blares of horns from other drivers, and got out. Then he simply stared, looked, and listened. But for what, he didn't know. Couldn't imagine. Being stationary and closer to the bridge didn't improve the visibility up there. The top of the embankment still disappeared into impenetrable darkness where it met the bridge. He looked across the road at the opposite embankment, but he could see the top of its slope quite clearly. It leveled off up there, forming a small ledge upon which someone could sit or sleep. A beer bottle stood next to a blaze of gang graffiti, but here on this side, the shadows were too thick. Who's that tripping over my bridge? Jesse? He didn't know why he called her name. Of course he'd imagine the sound of her voice calling for him. Of course. It was nothing more than a memory ghost now, like him. Hell, they both been ghosts for so long, haunting what should have been happier lives. Still, he called her name again as if it were some act of penance. It clouded in the cold air, chill as the grave, then wisped away. He looked straight up and remembered how the block of concrete appeared as it fell on him. Maybe if he stood here long enough, it would happen again. David returned to his car. He avoided looking at the black space as he gunned the engine and tore away. Despite having plans to go out at least once over the weekend, the trash wouldn't haul itself out to the bins. David remained inside the entire time. He'd given himself a pep talk on the way home from school that Friday, telling himself he would scrape together enough to go out to a movie and maybe grab a pizza afterward. He would clean the kitchen and bathroom and well, a whole damn place. Maybe even go wild and open the drapes to let in some light. Anything to make the place look different. Anything to hide away the memory, the echoes, the lingering smell of Jesse's memory. The incident under the bridge had unnerved him deeply. Oh, sure, he'd heard about how a guilty conscience could cause someone to hallucinate, but he'd always thought that was all so much happy psych 101 horse shit. But he knew he'd heard something under the bridge. Okay, sure, maybe it'd just been a combination of things. Wind, the sound of other cars, the echo of children playing in the distance. But whatever the elements were, they combined to create, for that moment, the sound of Jesse's voice calling for her da. He knew he was losing it, but he had to do something to stop himself from falling any further into that black pit of despair he'd been excavating for himself, especially with the anniversary of Jesse's death so fast approaching. Monday. It would be 1 year Monday. He couldn't let this go on. He'd once heard that the best way to honor someone's memory is to live your life as well as you can. Well, he hadn't been honoring Jesse's life for shit. He hadn't very much honored her while she was alive, but if there was a heaven she went to, maybe now she knew he missed. Oh, give me a goddamn break. Felt her absence every moment of every hour of every day. Unlocking the front door, he nodded to himself, convinced he was about to move on, to get on with things. He walked inside, closed the door, turned on the lights, opened the closet to hang up his coat, and saw her wheelchair, folded, leaning against the back wall. And all his moving on plans were crushed under an unseen falling slab. He pushed aside all the coats, including her fuzzy winter coat purchased at the Goodwill store for $3. God, how she loved that sad ass thing. And stared at the chair as if it were a dangerous stray animal. The stare down continued for almost 2 minutes before he finally reached inside and pulled the thing out, unfolding it as if it were time to get Jesse ready to go someplace. He knelt down, then setting the brakes, and looked it over. Still in solid working condition. He almost smiled. He'd kept in a pretty good shape over the years, if he did say so himself. Remembering Jesse's favorite Christmas television show, he paraphrased the Grinch as he patted the chair and said, "You're the best. You're the first fucking thing to go." Releasing the brakes, he rolled the chair toward the front door. He'd park it by the side and call AmVets to donate it, but no sooner had he gripped the handles than the subtle chill of a physical memory crept up his arms and into his chest. It's too light. Why isn't this harder to push? Has she been losing weight? He stopped halfway through the living room, his hands gripping the handle so tightly that he heard his bones crack. And for the first time, David Brolin actually looked at the chair in which his daughter spent the majority of her life. It was in good working order, sure, but dear God, it was a shabby-looking thing. Pathetic, even. He saw the indentions made by her buttocks and back in the faux leather material. Even the shapes of the thick foam pillows that supported areas where her body was too twisted to sit up properly. He released the handles, walked around it to confront it, face on, and felt something in his center give out. "What was it like for you, Jesse?" "I never asked. Never even thought about it. Would you have even told me? Or was da the beginning, middle, and end of your vocabulary of pain expressed only in those refrigerator scribbles I pretended to appreciate? It's feeling beyond guilt, beyond self-loathing, even beyond the miserable relief he'd felt at her death. There was something almost transcendent about it, hinting at a taste of grace if only he could find the way." He went back to the closet, dug around through the shoes and gloves and broken toys until he found the thick foam pillows he'd used to pack her into position, then returned to the chair and sat down in it, placing the pillows under his ass and arms, against the small of his back, behind his neck, until he achieved something like the twisted position he'd sculpted his daughter into every day. It was agony, sitting like this. It was agony. Yet he smiled. It was agony. But this was not punishment. Nor was it penance. It was right and proper. Maybe it would bring them closer together. He remained in that chair all night, even going so far as to wet himself, as she so often had. And around 4 a.m., when the world was so still and silent, it was easy to believe it had all run away and abandoned him, wondering if Jesse had ever felt so alone and forgotten and left behind, he whispered very softly, in a tone similar to his dead daughter's, "Da." No one answered his call. And for the first time since his daughter's death, David Brolin wept. But for whom, he couldn't have said.
David was finishing up cleaning after the last Monday lunches were served when Ray appeared at his shoulder, unexpected and unbidden, like a bad memory. David was by now more than familiar with the manner in which bad memories appeared, having all but issued them an ongoing invitation. He had no desire to deal with Mr. Let's Go Get Us Some Hooker Tang today. Jesse's clothes and wheelchair were folded up in the car and ready for delivery to Ambetts and Goodwill. He finally managed to pull himself out of his fugue or funk or whatever in the fuck state he'd been in and gather together her things to donate. Maybe physically handing the items to another person, knowing he would never deal with them again, would help. What wouldn't help was Ray, and he turned to tell the other man as much. It took him a moment to find his voice, because Ray, ponytailed, semi-sloppy, pale-faced Ray, who looked as if he spent most of his time avoiding any contact with direct light or a shower, looked utterly transformed. Healthy color filled his face. His hair shone brightly and smelled of jasmine-scented shampoo. The clothes he usually wore under his uniform were clean and neatly pressed. Hard to believe this was the same slob who always slung crude comments at him. "Looks like the weekend didn't treat you any better than the last one," the custodian said. David looked away. What is it now?
"Need to come with me tonight, partner. Seriously?"
The man's voice was hoarse and hollow.
David shook his head. "I can't afford to go out for a couple of goddamn beers, Ray, let alone afford a hooker." He grabbed his coat and started for the door when Ray seized his arm. "Listen, partner, don't hit me, okay? Look, I'm letting go. Dave, I'm stepping back. Just, would you please listen to me?"
David decided it would be easier to let him have his say than to argue. He sighed, looked around, and nodded.
"Look, partner. Everybody sees me around here with my mop and bucket, and they figure, you know, I'm just some ignorant slob ain't worth the shit he cleans up. Like I got no feelings or got, you know, lonely or stuff. Okay, so maybe I ain't the classiest guy who ever walked through a set of doors, but I'm better than a lot of scumbags out there. Look at my eyes, partner. Look, I ain't lonely no more. This chick I've been seeing,
you mean this hooker?"
Ray shook his head. "It ain't like that. Ain't no crack whore or nothing. She's different. Finer. She just doesn't like take money from you and lay there while you fuck her. She gives you something back."
He looked down at his feet and laughed.
"Hell, last couple of times there ain't even been any screwing. I leave feeling good, you know, like never before. Makes it easier to deal with my shitty excuse for a laugh."
"So you're what? Banging Mother Teresa?"
"Don't make fun of her like that!"
Ray glanced around to make sure no one had heard him raise his voice.
"Don't make it sound stupid and dirty. I feel like a new man because of her. Only reason I keep asking you to go is because, well, you ain't been the same since your little girl died. Not that you were little last before, but..."
David stared into the custodian's eyes. There was no need for Ray to finish what he'd begun to say. David already knew how everyone looked at him. "So you're telling me what? If I go see this hooker, I'll be a new man just like you?"
Ray smiled. His face nearly beamed. "Yeah, something like that."
"Why do you give a shit anyway?" Can't say, partner. I just know this chick, she, like, needs to take away what pains you. Oh, God, she does. It was those last four words that did it. It told David in no uncertain terms that Ray had experienced something that was, at least to him, damn near miraculous. Jesus, could just getting laid do that to a man? Erase years of doubt, guilt, loneliness, and all the rest of it. It had been years since David had last been with a woman. Too long, for sure. He couldn't believe he was actually considering this. How do you know this girl's safe? She's clean. You sure? Been going to her 5 months now, partner, and ain't caught nothing yet. David rubbed his eyes. I can't afford it. I got just enough money for gas and a few groceries, and that's it till payday. Ray gripped David's arm. Today's our anniversary, you know? Come along with me tonight. It'll be my treat. He leaned in. Besides, you don't always want money. Maybe you got something else you need. David thought about this for several moments, and then decided that he spent too much time considering things. When was the last time he just went crazy in a good way? Did something impulsive and fun? Don't think about it. If you think about it, you won't go. I'll drive, he said. David knew where they were heading, even before Ray told him to skip the West 25 exit and head toward Whipple Road. The goddamn bridge. Wherever this hooker did her business, it was somewhere in the vicinity of the bridge. They were passing under the car, nearly swallowed in shadows, when Ray said, "Pull over and park." There must have been a half a dozen cars parked off to the side in the shadows. The Johns who drove them here were all milling around near the left side slope that now rose up, not into deepest darkness, but toward a rounded tunnel, shining with a soft, golden red glow. As he got out of the car, David asked, "Is that a drainage pipe?" "No, that's where she lives." "Lives? You mean to tell me she lives on a fucking drainage pipe, yet she's supposed to be so clean?" "You find redemption in the damnedest places, don't you?" Before David could reply, there was a cry from deep inside the pipe. The cry of a man experiencing a physical ecstasy unlike any he'd ever known. It was sexuality in the cry, that couldn't be denied, but it was so much more. A sound that David could only think of as bliss. A few moments later, the man staggered out, fastening his belt, running a shaking hand through his hair. The other men gathered at the bottom of the slope, watched with a kind of expectant awe. Ray pushed David forward. "Your turn." "But wait a goddamn second, will you? The others were here first."
"We're not real big on pecking order here,"
one of the men said, walking toward them.
"We come to her in the order she wishes."
"And she wished for you to come up as you arrived," another said. "That's what I promised," Ray added. David stared at him. "You promised?" Ray shrugged. "Why do you think I've been such a pest?" He nodded toward the pipe. "She makes you want to be a better man. One who keeps his word, you know." They all gathered around David and pushed him toward the golden red glow. He tried to protest, but his voice was suddenly gone. All he could manage was a soft, garbled, "Bah." And then he was there, standing at the entrance. The glow of the lights from inside warming his skin like a summer sun in childhood. "Go on," someone said. He was vaguely aware of Ray standing at his elbow. "But..."
"Shh, just go on, partner."
Strong arms pushed him into the room, smelling of jasmine, sweat, ears, gum. A thick mattress sat in the middle of the room. And upon it, kneeling with her back to him, wearing a see-through robe, the most physically beautiful woman he'd ever seen. Even though she had yet to turn toward him, her beauty, her grace, her sensual power, been enough to cause David to feel weak. His legs felt as if they would give out at any moment. His chest and throat felt tight. His arms were useless appendages. His whole body was imploding.
Anticipation.
Tried once again.
began to speak, but could only manage. "Well, it's all right," she said in a musical voice. "I know it's hard, being here for the first time." She turned toward him. "But it'll get easier, duh. I promise." David Brolin found himself face to face with his daughter. With the Jesse he'd always wished for. Grown up, healthy, vibrant. With the lithe body of a dancer or athlete. So beautiful. So perfect. So perfect. So perfect. He reached for her to touch her perfect cheek, her skin like porcelain, and saw that his hand was no longer as it had been. What hung from the end of his arm looked more like a claw. And his arm was twisting into an impossible position. He felt it. Oh, the pain, the agonizing pain as his body altered, his spine, his hips and legs, his neck, even his jaw shifted into position as he clashed to the floor with, just as his legs began their final metamorphosis. Two pairs of hands grabbed him beneath his arms and helped him gently into the wheelchair that appeared behind him. "You'll need pillows," his daughter said. Ray and one of the others crossed reverently to her bed and grabbed up several pillows, then arranged them around and under David's twisted body so he would be more comfortable. Jesse then disrobed, standing naked before the three of them. "I always loved you, Da," she said to the thing that was her father. "I only wished you could love me back." She got down on her hands and knees as Ray and the other man unbuckled their belts and removed their pants, their erections firm and dripping. "I'm going to show you love, Da, in all the ways you wished for it, in all the ways I can never experience it. But don't worry, I still love you, and I'll take care of you." David drooled down the side of his chin and tried to wipe it away. He managed only to soil himself. "We'll wipe you up in a few minutes. But first, I have to keep my promises."
David could only watch, unable to close his eyes or turn his head away, as Ray penetrated her anus and the other man slid into her mouth. But still, he heard her voice, the same ghostly echo from days before.
"I love you, Daw. Welcome home. We'll be so happy."
Thank you for listening to Under the Bridge Downtown by Matthew Warner and Gary A. Bronbeck, narrated by Matthew Warner. We will have more information about them in our show notes and on our MySpace and LiveJournal pages. To find out more about Variant Frequencies, please go to our website at www.variantfrequencies.com. If you like Variant Frequencies, tell your friends about us. Thank you from the Variant Frequencies team, Matt Wallace, Ann Stringer, and Rick Stringer.
Something new from Patiobooks.com.
In a future where noir, cyberpunk, and visceral horror make mind-bending bedfellows, the only thing that separates a forsaken urban sprawl from a half-finished technological utopia is 16 miles of river. They're known as the Failed Cities. Two worlds populated by shadow agents, street soldiers, reluctant detectives, and femme fatales. When a single conspiracy touches them all, the story can only be told in their voices. Ethan, the street preacher, truck, the hot-rodding neo-hipster, knifesmith, the feral twins, whose passion for death and each other is the only escape from their own tormented psyches. Just a few of the characters that drive one of the most unique storytelling experiences in fiction today. J.C. Hutchins, author of the Seventh Son trilogy, calls the failed city's monologues gritty, imaginative, believable. T. Morris, author of Moravi, says the failed city's monologues creates a chilling tapestry of inner darkness that finds its outside voice. It's not a matter of wanting to listen. You have to. Visit PodioBooks.com to hear the series that's redefining the rules of podcast fiction. Variant Frequencies presents The Failed Cities Monologues by Matt Wallace. 8 lives, 2 cities, 1 story.
Get this book and more free titles from PodioBooks.com.
Attention all evildoers. Beware the Moon Wraith.
The Moon Wraith! A vengeful ghost for justice is actually Virgil Caine, traveler, adventurer, and amateur detective. Uncovering mysteries he learned in the Far East, he is able to project his spirit during the full moon to right wrongs against those who would prey on the helpless. Starring Sam Atwood as Virgil Caine, the Moon Wraith.
It was a series of little things, like you being naked in my apartment trying to seduce me.
Peggy West as wealthy socialite Sandra Ashton.
No, I mean you have all this free time for crime fighting. You have a nice apartment on the west side. You wear the finest clothes, but I don't know how you can afford it all.
And Dustin Hearn as plucky newsboy, Krabby Jones.
Great party, huh, Mr. Caine?
Krabby? How did you get in here?
Gee whiz, Mr. Caine. I'm not going to be a newsboy forever. I'm going to be a reporter.
Tune in for the continuing adventures of The Moon Wraith.
This is going to hurt.